Ethics is otherwise called moral philosophy, and this is the investigation into ideal qualities of the human being, which are actually the proof of proper philosophical understanding, or the proof that a person has actually achieved the truth, which is the goal of philosophy. So, in old Greek philosophy, there was this formulation that someone could try to convince others of the truth, or what he thought was the truth, by three different means. And this is, I think, instructive for us. So the first way to try to convince another of the truth is by pathos. Pathos translates from Greek as, you can say it's passion, or vigorous debate or vigorous argument. So someone who's convinced that what he thinks is right then in great enthusiasm, with great emotion, may try to convince another. But this, it was considered not so effective, because this type of enthusiasm, it can pass very quickly. You may be able to, we have this ISKCON expression, fire someone up. You see, you can fire someone up. But if all he has to go on, if all he has to fuel this fire is just passionate enthusiasm, then, as we've often seen in time, sometimes in very short time, that fades away. So then, another strategy superior to pathos is logos. We've already talked about logos, that means logic. So to give good, sound arguments, logical reasons, this is better, but it is still not considered the best. The best way to convince another person of the correctness of your point of view, of the truth that you have come to understand, is ethos, or ethics, good moral character, good moral conduct. When we see, here is a person whose character is beyond the shadow of a doubt, faultless, then it is natural that we place our faith in that person. It is natural that we trust this person, that he'll not cheat me. You see? Even he may be speaking all the right things. Logically, there's no mistake that we can find in his presentation. But if we notice that his character is questionable, then still there will be a reservation, some shadow of reservation in our heart. What's really going to happen to me if I surrender to this person? I mean, everything he says sounds okay, but I don't know. And then, of course, down here, if it's just someone browbeating us, you see, just with not even necessarily following logic at all, but just enthusiastic formulations, then you may feel pressured into, for a short time, going along with him, but there's really nothing there to hold you. So this is, I start with this to show you how ethics or moral philosophy is very important for us. It is very important to the success of our preaching mission. Srila Prabhupada formulated the same thing in his expression, that example is better than precept. The precept means a doctrinal principle. You see, a principle of our teaching, Vaishnava philosophy, that's a precept, or any philosophy. So we have so many nice precepts, but the most convincing argument is the example of the preacher. So this was Srila Prabhupada's own formulation. So ethics is very vital. So now, I want to refer here to the Srimad Bhagavatam. Two verses in the fourth canto. The first is from Canto 4, Chapter 20, which is entitled Lord Vishnu's Appearance in the Sacrificial Arena. And the verse number is text 16. So here, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is speaking with Maharaj Prithu. And he's glorifying him. He's glorifying him for his qualities. So when we speak of ethics or moral philosophy, then what we are speaking of in our Vaishnava doctrine is what it would be transformed into a Western terminology as what they call virtue ethics. Virtue means, actually the word comes from Latin, virtus, and it literally means strength. We have in English the word virile, which is a word meaning masculine strength. It's a word that is usually linked to very strong, manly men who are heroes. So in Sanskrit also, there's the term viryas. Viryas means powerful. Virya or vira means hero. So these terms are, etymologically, you can see, very similar. So virtue in modern English language, you must have a, probably in Danish, a word similar to the German word, Tugend. Do you have some word like that? No?
Yeah.
What? What is the word for when you say goodness? Okay. Anyway, how does virtue translate? Do you know?
Deeds.
Okay. Yes, anyway, so, but in the English language, yes, virtue means moral strength. There's this idea from virtus of strength, but it no longer means so much this, you know, muscular. Actually, it comes from that in the sense that in the old cultures like Greek and Roman cultures, then a man should be, the ideal was a noble warrior, you see, a hero, like in the Greek legends, Achilles or Apollo, they were great heroes. So in those cultures, men would aspire to be like them. That was the ideal figures. So they were fighters, they were heroes in that sense, but they also were supposed to be very moral. It's like the word chivalry also in English means that. So virtue has come down not so much to mean like a Kshatriya type person, but just a person who is morally very strong and who has qualities which cannot be overcome by the, you know, attraction to sinfulness. He's morally very, very firm. So these virtues, they refer to qualities. So I'm telling you this because in Western philosophy, there are different formulations of ethics. You know, there's different, like, ethical doctrines. So ours, the Vaishnava doctrine, most resembles this, what is called virtue ethics.
that to be moral, you have to be virtuous. You have to have virtues. You have to have ideal characteristics in your character, ideal qualities in your character. These must be developed. So in traditional Christianity, there were actually seven virtues. It's not really so important to mention them because we're going to be talking about the Vaishnava formulation of the same virtues. So, so this is one, virtue ethics. There are some other formulations of ethics in the Western philosophies which have to do with man's duty, the formulations of duty, or there's another idea of social contract, that for the good of all society we should be good. These are speculative, and actually it's this moral philosophy in the West is a great tangle, and I don't want to talk that much about it because this is probably the issue in philosophy that is the most unclear. You see, they don't really know what morality is to begin with, because it's a Malecha civilization. So the arguments are very, I mean, when you see them, when you read them, from a Vaishnav point of view, they're very primitive arguments and very, they're not, I don't even think they're worth discussing. But anyway, if there's anything that resembles our Vaishnav philosophy, it's this virtue ethics. So this is what Lord Vishnu is praising Maharaj Prithu for, his virtues, or his ideal qualities of his personality. So let's hear what the Supreme Lord says. My dear king, can someone give me this water? My dear king, I am very much captivated by your elevated qualities and excellent behavior. And thus I am very favorably inclined toward you. You may therefore ask from me any benediction you like. One who does not possess elevated qualities and behavior cannot possibly achieve my favor simply by performance of sacrifices, severe austerities, or mystic yoga. But I always remain equipoised in the heart of one who is also equipoised in all circumstances. So this one verse is a very, very complete explanation of Vaishnava virtue ethics. That there are spiritual qualities which great devotees manifest. And by these qualities, they attract the Supreme Lord. As we see here, the Lord has actually appeared personally in the sacrificial arena of Maharaj Prithu. He's not hiding himself. He's appeared himself personally. And here he's telling Maharaj Prithu why I've come, why I'm showing myself to you and all members of your kingdom is because you are so good. You are such an ideal personality. Therefore, the Lord is attracted to associate with such persons as Maharaj Prithu, such ideal devotees, because of their wonderful characteristics. And he says, because of this, I am prepared to give you whatever you desire, whatever you may ask. So this is you can see, if you think of this a little deeply, you can see here's the difference between the benedictions offered by Lord Vishnu and the benedictions offered by a demigod, even like Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva will offer benedictions even to a demon, you see, even to a Vritrasura, who worshipped Lord Shiva by cutting off his flesh and offering it into the fire of sacrifice. His heart was full of all kinds of nasty things. But still Lord Shiva appeared before him and said, whatever you like, don't do this. Because Lord Shiva is very kind. This is not meant to be a criticism of Lord Shiva, but it just shows the difference. Lord Shiva said, don't do this. It's embarrassing and that you're cutting your own body to pieces in my name. So stop this and tell me what you want and I'll give it to you. So then this demon was such a rascal that He wanted the benediction that whoever head he would touch would crack into 1,000 pieces. So Lord Shiva gave him that. And Lord Shiva knew, it's right there in the Krishna book, in this narration. Lord Krishna knew, as soon as he heard this, that here is one, this person is crazy. This person is a sinful demon. But still he was bound. He felt himself obliged. He had to give this thing. And then what did the demon want to do immediately? He began to think of Lord Shiva's beautiful wife and wanted to touch his head, the head of the very person who gave him the benediction, to crack his head so that he could steal Lord Shiva's wife. So he wanted to immediately do some sinful mischief. So you see, because demigod worship is materialistic, it is a product of the action and reaction of the material modes of nature. And therefore, the qualities of the demigod worshipper are not important in the relationship. It's simply the demigod worshipper goes through whatever mechanical duties he should perform, and then the demigod reciprocates. So it's a kind of mechanical thing, and it creates havoc, as we can see. Of course, ultimately everything is arranged for the good, because the Lord is behind this Vedic arrangement. But still, Vritrasura created havoc. Hiranyakashipu, who is blessed by Lord Brahma, he created havoc. Ravana created havoc. So, but with the Vaishnava, how can this happen? Because the Vaishnava, in order to come to such a position where he receives the full favor of the Lord, he must have all auspicious, all good personal qualities. Huh? Good virtues and good behavior. So the Lord is there, is at that point, he is perfectly willing to give anything and everything to his devotee because he knows he will not misuse it. He will use it only in my service. So, and the Lord goes on to say, one who does not possess elevated qualities and behavior cannot possibly achieve my favor simply by performance of sacrifices, severe austerities, or mystic yoga. So here he's cutting out this whole demigod worship type approach, which simply consists of this, sacrifices, austerities, and yoga. That's a mechanical process. And here, then in the final sentence, the Lord is indicating how one can recognize a virtuous person. He first gives the example of himself as Paramatma. As Paramatma, he is within everyone's heart. So these living entities are in all different kinds of material situations. But the Lord in the heart is always equipoised. He is not that particular living entity, let's say in the body of a hog, is as soon as his nose smells stool, and then he's seized by the urge to rush to that stool and gobble it up. So this is not equipoised. But the Lord in the heart is equipoised. Even though he's in the heart of such a creature, he is not affected by that creature's attachments or his aversions. He is always transcendentally established in neutrality. And so he says, the same is about my devotee. My devotee is in this world. And of course, this world is a vast display of all different kinds of mentalities and material situations. But my devotee is unaffected by it. So this is virtue. This is moral strength. Now, there's another important lesson to be learned. This is spoken by Maharaj Prithu to the four Kumaras. This is in chapter 22 of the same fourth canto, text number 7. King Prithu spoke, "My dear great sages, auspiciousness personified, it is very difficult for even the mystic yogis to see you. Indeed, you are very rarely seen. I do not know what kind of pious activity I performed for you to grace me by appearing before me without difficulty. So what do we learn from this? We learn that when one has these ideal moral qualifications or virtues, then one's consciousness is expanded. Here it's very clear. Maharishi Pitu says, it is very, very difficult to see sages like the four Kumaras. Only one who has amassed a great deal of pious activities is able to see them. So Maharishi Pitu is saying, somehow or other, I have those qualifications and therefore I am so fortunate to see you. So there was some question earlier seminar, this fifth canto questions about the universe and how to work it out, what we see, you know, through scientific instruments, that description of the universe and what we read in the fifth canto. So yes, what is missing? What is missing is this high level of virtue. Because there is this universe as described in the Vedic scriptures is the moral dimension. And so when one's moral qualifications or one's virtue is not so developed, then one is not able, for example, to see the four Kumaras, to see the true form of the universe, to see the true form of reality. So this is another very important point. By virtue, by the development of virtuous qualities, then consciousness expands and we can actually have darshan of the truth. So now, I want to go on to present seven virtues, seven ideal characteristics, which are presented by Bhaktivinoda Thakur in one of his works, the Sri Chaitanya Shikshamritam. So, Nyaya, or justice, Daya, mercy, Satya, truthfulness, pavitrata, pure character, maitri, friendship, toward other living entities. Arjava, honesty, and Preeti, loving kindness, so it's interesting. This fascinates me that in traditional Christianity they had seven virtues, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur presents these seven. Now, this list of seven you'll find included in, for example, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there are the 26 qualities of the Vaishnava. So these seven are included there. In the Bhagavad Gita, there are lists like the Daivi Sampat, the divine qualities. You'll also find these are very similar qualities, these seven. So why does Bhaktivinoda Thakur focus particularly on these seven? Since there are lists of others that include many more qualities, and we're going to refer to that also in a few minutes. But what is important about these seven? So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that when the living entity comes into his own swarup, or when his own spiritual nature is made evident, as happens when one is well established in the mode of goodness. We can think of this example of the material existence like a deep pool. So at the surface of the pool, the water is illuminated. So when one is at the surface, then others can see quite clearly the form of that swimmer, because he's on the surface. If he dives down, as he goes deeper, then the form becomes more and more obscured by darkness until it completely disappears. He's still there, but his particular personal qualities and the form of his body are not visible when he goes down deep. So in this way, we can understand the three modes of material nature. The mode of goodness is, you can say, the surface of material existence. It is the region which is in closest proximity to the spiritual atmosphere, to Brahman, or the spiritual sky. So those living entities who are situated in the mode of goodness, Brahmanas and Vaishnavas, then their swarup, their spiritual form or spiritual characteristics become quite evident, quite visible. And so these seven are virtues which are universally recognized anywhere and everywhere. Persons who have these qualities are respected as being good, practically in any culture. Persons who exhibit these qualities to some extent or other are considered good and are therefore respected. So when one comes to the pure mode of goodness, Shuddha Sattva mode of goodness, then these qualities are nicely manifest. In the mode of passion, then they're hazy, difficult to see. And in the mode of ignorance, they cannot be seen. They're totally covered. So this is interesting to note, that every living entity has these qualities as a natural aspect of their spiritual identity. But only when we rise up to the mode of goodness, at least, what to speak of coming to the transcendental position, are these qualities self-evident. So then what of the other qualities? So for instance, in the 26 qualities of the Vaishnava, these qualities are there and others, but Lord Krishna, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he says concerning these, that the essential quality of the Vaishnava, which is not listed here, is Krishna Ekasharana, is that one is always surrendered to Krishna. What Bhaktivinoda Thakur says is that if one has this one quality, then all of these others will develop. Now, for common people, ordinary people, because their consciousness is so polluted and so turned away from Krishna, they may not be able to recognize the value of someone who is surrendered to Krishna. They may think it's weird. They may meet a devotee and think, what, a Hare Krishna devotee? These people are cuckoo. You see? But therefore, these qualities are important to them. You see? These are what they can recognize as virtues. They may not be able to immediately appreciate that here's someone who's surrendered to Krishna. But if they can also see in that person, very nicely exhibited, these seven characteristics, then they will be persuaded, as per what we presented in the beginning. They will be presented, be persuaded that, oh, this person is good, and therefore I should accept what this person says. So that is the significance here. Now, just by developing these qualities alone, without surrender to Krishna, one cannot become free from this material, or at least one cannot, one can perhaps attain some kind of liberation and personal liberation, but one cannot attain the personal association of the Lord. So there's a statement by a great Vaishnavacharya, Jiva Jnana Yogyo Api Shravanadiman Api Na Svashakta Bhagavantam Pashyati. Bhagavantam Pashyati. So the statement is that a jiva may be very qualified in spiritual knowledge, and he may have excellent moral qualifications. But that alone is not enough, Bhagavantam Pashyati, to permit one to have darshan of Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So how does one come into direct association of the Lord? Therefore, this one quality, Krishna Eka Sharana, to be surrendered to Krishna and Krishna alone, is most important. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that if we have this, if we surrender to Krishna, then all other ideal qualities, he says that is the Swarup Lakshana, that is the essential qualification of the devotee. That is the Swarup, yes. And the Lakshana, these are Lakshana. Lakshana means these are embellishments. Embellishments? These are embellishments to the glory of the devotee. Additional features of his glories. But the central glory, that which actually connects him with Krishna, is his complete surrender to Krishna. So by surrendering to Krishna, if one actually does that properly, then these virtues will be manifest. And by these manifest virtues, then one will be able to be very effective in preaching, because it is by this, by his example, that he will be able to persuade others of the truth of Krishna consciousness. So I would like to stop here and ask if there are any questions. Yes?
What about this virtue, this story, for example, Dhruva Maharaj? Was it so that he was this Krishna Eka Sarana? That's why he got the darshan of Lord Krishna.
Yes.
Because seemingly he didn't so much exhibit his characters.
Well, he was motivated in his bhakti yoga practice by a strong desire to become the foremost of Kshatriyas in the universe. To become recognized as the greatest of the kingly order. And that is a material motivation. But he was very, very determined. And he followed his mother's instructions without deviation. His mother was, if you want to achieve such status, only you're just a helpless boy, 5 years old, even your father has rejected you. So you'll have to take shelter of Krishna. There's no one else who can help you. So he accepted his mother as guru, these instructions as guru, vani, and he executed his austerity and penance to the Lord without any deviation, with full determination. In this way, he surrendered to the Lord, and yes, as you've said, then he could have the darshan of the Lord. And then having that darshan, then he felt ashamed for his material motivation. And he wanted to give it up, but the Lord said, no, never mind. That is also within my plan. And so he, after reigning on this earth for 30,000 years, then was promoted to the Dhruvaloka, the personal planet of the Lord. He became the king there, managing things in Dhruvaloka on behalf of the Lord. This was the service the Lord gave him. Yes?
Why does correct philosophy necessarily lead to correct ethics, or what you say, what was a test of correct philosophy, proper ethics?
Because ethics means behavior. So this is just universal understanding. It's quite logical that if we accept that, for example, if we can all agree that God is good, and that knowing God is good, and that goodness is ideal, the truth is ideal, so then it follows that a person who is God conscious, who knows the truth, will exhibit within his person goodness, ideal qualities. If a person claims to know this summum bonum, supreme good, God, supreme truth, and is unquestionably a rascal, then nobody's going to believe him. This is just universal. I don't think this really requires a big explanation. It's just the way people are. Yeah?
Atheistic materialistic philosophers, will they also agree to that point?
Yes. They will, but their point is, of course, the truth is not a god. But they have this, even like Marxists. Everything hinges on ethics. That if you've actually understood Marx, and you're actually following Marx in your life, then you are supposed to be an ideal person, a good person. They have their... their leaders, their acharyas, who are supposedly the best Marxists. And so they become their leading figures. And, Lenin, Stalin, whoever it is, the big pictures, the parade. Of course, these were complete demons, and it was just propaganda that they were good men. But this is human nature. Yeah? This is human nature. This expectation is there. If you've actually understood things rightly, then your character will be ideal. Yes?
Guru Maharaj, it sometimes seems that followers of other religious traditions also they seem to manifest these good qualities and pure character. But having heard your explanation of the whole Western religious tradition, it seems strange how it could be so.
Well, if they're following a religious tradition which has any value, then there will be some touch of goodness to it. And so to the degree that there's goodness, then to some degree, these qualities, which are natural to the soul, will shine forth in these persons. But when you talk of Western religions, then this, the appearance of these qualities is also rather meager. It's there. I mean, a religious person is generally seen to be a bit better than non-religious people, but they're meat eaters. Nobody thinks meat eating is wrong in this culture. So therefore, Daya, Maitri, Priti, this comes out in a very limited and conditioned way. And the Bhagavatam says, 11th canto says, is that generally what is seen is that there is only goodness for one's own group, one's immediate family members, or you can extend that a little bit, one's friends and neighbors, one's co-religionists. One may see these qualities being expanded to them, but never to all living entities.
So they show mercy to some, but, you know, just like the Christians, many of them are anti-abortion, and they say how horrible it is to kill the fetus within the womb. But at the same time, they have no qualms about killing their own mother, cow, and eating her flesh. So this is a great contradiction. In China, I read, the Chinese, you know, you can say they're more practical. They're having many, many abortions in China. It's very much encouraged. And China has a great population. So there are many, many abortions. And so they take the fetuses and they turn them into soup and such things, preparations. And the Chinese doctors highly recommend for health. They have said that it's good for kidneys, and, you know, they told women it's good for your complexion to eat aborted fetuses. And so then this is reported in Western newspapers with, you know, in a scandalous light, you know, these crazy Chinese, look what they're, but what, really, what is the difference? I mean, when you come right down to it, because look at what the Western people eat. They're fond of eating all kinds of living entities. So, you know, for someone to be eating, because Prabhupada said, you know, when a child, newborn or child within the womb, it's like an animal. It's not developed as a human being yet. But because it's like an animal doesn't mean we can kill and eat it. So those, they try to respect human life, but then they kill these other forms of life. So really, you know, and this is where all the problems of this moral philosophy comes about, because of these deep contradictions in how people define goodness. And therefore it's all just a big mass of arguments, and it's best not even to get into it. It's not really moral philosophy, it's just politics. As different people take their different positions as to what they think is good, and they argue back and forth. But for the Vaishnava, a moral philosophy or virtue ethics, it is self-evident. It is self-evident. If one is practicing Krishna consciousness properly, then these ideal qualities will be manifest, and Srila Prabhupada always insisted that it is this that is the proof. This is the proof of the practice. And this is what will convince others. Yes?
Out of these seven, these six are seems to be very precise, but this pure character is more like it could include all the others. What does this pure character
mean? Well, it means sinlessness. Pavitrata means... these are specific virtues, good qualities. But pavitrata means, no sinfulness. So this is just what we were explaining. Somebody adhering to some religion may exhibit some of these good qualities. But if you see at the same time sinfulness in this person, like he's meat-eating, he's taking intoxicants or whatever... then this is immediately showing some defect in character. Yes.
How do you define justice in Bhakti's definition?
Yeah, justice means that one is there's just like in the West, the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and in Lord Krishna's instructions to Uddhava, there's a verse in which he presents the same principle. So this is seeing others as one would see oneself, and dealing with others as one deals with oneself. In other words, it's natural that we all favor ourselves. We all want the best for ourselves. So one who is actually
just. It's not just himself versus the world, but he wants the whole world to be included in proper dealings. And if wherever there's improper dealings, wherever there is exploitation, injustice, then he wants that rectified.
Truthfulness and absolute honesty.
Truthfulness means telling the truth. Honesty means behaving in a way which does not mislead others. They're different, you know. Anyway, Bill Clinton is an example of this. He claims to have precisely told the truth, yet they're after him because they see at the same time he was doing so many things to hide the truth. What came out of his mouth, he says, and they even contest that this is not true, but he claims, because he's a good lawyer, he claims that what he spoke was the truth. But they say, but your behavior was totally dishonest.
Truthfulness and integrity, Western public form.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was the difference between moral and ethics? I mean, it's more or less the same word.
Yeah. And they're synonyms. Anything else? Yes?
Said that breaking each of the four regulative principles, you also diminish some of these qualities that are there also. So I was thinking taking intoxication, what quality does that, is that cleanliness or dimension?
Well, devotees, I've seen discussions of this, and you know, when you go into it, into great detail, into different purports by Srila Prabhupada, then it's not so clear how to match them up. So, because in different purports, Srila Prabhupada says different things. So, but I think it is just safe to say, in general, that if one eats meat, has illicit sex, gambles, or takes intoxication, then these ideal qualities are cut down. It's following Prabhupada's books, you can't exactly match them up, so I don't want to get into that. Yes?
Sometimes it seems that somebody might be practicing like external devotional service very nicely, but still, even after many years, he doesn't exhibit these qualities, or he exhibits qualities that are contrary to this. How is this to be understood?
Well, you see, I was just reading the other day, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is writing in Harinam Chintanami that one can at any time, even one has attained a very exalted position in devotional service, but at any time one can slide back. Krishna consciousness is personal. So what does personal mean? It means moment by moment there's a choice. We are dealing with Krishna in our relationship with Krishna. So moment by moment, we are to choose to love and to serve him with greater and greater devotion. But at any time we have the option to choose differently. So you see, what is the meaning of it? We have to be clear on this. What does it mean to be an advanced devotee? An advanced devotee is not one who's, you know, like these modern planes. They can fly automatically on computer, and then the pilots can leave the cabin and go hang out with the passengers and have drinks, you know, and the plane flies itself. This is mechanical, so we should not conceive of advancement in Krishna consciousness to be some state where I don't have to try hard anymore, I don't have to pay attention anymore, everything's just going to happen and I can space out. You know, it's not like that. Advancement in devotional service means that one is always choosing, it's a conscious choice, moment by moment by moment through all eternity. And why does one always choose Krishna? Because one has such a taste, one has no other taste. That's advancement. See, taste, Prabhupada always taught us this way, like that whole question about, sometimes there's this question, are our actions predetermined? And Srila Prabhupada would always answer in terms of taste. It's your taste. Even in this material world. Why is it that someone is drawn again and again to certain material activities? Sometimes they think, I can't help myself. It's my fate. It's, you know, there's this strong power that controls me. But Prabhupada would not have this. Prabhupada did not explain it in that way. He said it's a matter of taste. It's a matter of the taste that we have cultivated. So this question, if Krishna knows everything, past, present, and future, then he knows what we're going to do in the future, then how are we independent? Because he already knows what we're going to do. But Prabhupada said, it's like, if I know that you have a taste for a certain, very strong taste for a certain kind of food stuff, let's say it's gulab jamun. You're just so eager to have gulab jamun and they're not often served. So you're always anxious that when gulab jamuns are served that you get some. So I see you here and I know that you are just wild about gulab jamuns, and I know that at this very moment, just out in the hallway, a table is being set up and there's a big jar of gulab jamuns. And when the devotees come out, the gulab jamuns will be offered to them. So I can accurately prophesize that when you go out of this room, you're going to be eating gulab jamuns within 1 minute. Because I know your taste. I know that you really like gulab jamuns. Now, my knowing this in no way interferes with your free will. By my knowing this, I am not somehow, you know, mystically robbing you of your free will. You're going to be eating those gulab jamuns because that's what you like. And I just happen to know that. So Srila Prabhupada said, this is Krishna's position. He knows everybody's taste perfectly. So he knows what we're going to do. At the same time, we have our free will. So Krishna consciousness, the pure stage of Krishna consciousness means that one has only taste for Krishna. Therefore, by one's free will, one is choosing moment by moment by moment to love and serve Krishna, and never chooses anything else. And that's all. It's not that he's, you know, like become some kind of Krishnaized zombie and doesn't know, has no conception of anything else. He's just programmed to serve Krishna. And therefore doesn't even have to, you know, it doesn't matter his state of consciousness. Prabhupada was emphatically against that. He was emphatically against that. He pointed to this as a difference between the Karmakanda philosophy and the philosophy of devotional service. The Karmakanda, they do all their duties with great exactness, but without any devotion to Krishna, without any taste to love and serve Krishna. They just perform the external activities because they're calculating the material results that will come from it. So this is mechanical, Prabhupada said. This is mechanical. When one is doing things for material, because the whole, as we said the other day, the whole material display, material universe, cosmos, is just a big machine. So when one acts for material motives, he's acting mechanically. Yes?
In this regard, many times I heard classes about in Bhagavad Gita, this verse, Svalpamapya Siddharma Yana, Trayato Mahato Maya. Especially in Sandhya, some devotees explaining to the guests that we have a kind of
account where when you do, now when you came to temple, you have 1% of Krishna bhakti, and next life, if you don't do anything else, it will. So this is exactly makes me to feel a little bit like this mechanically. Is this wrong way to speak?
What that means is that the more you do for Krishna, then the more you opportunity you get to do more for Krishna. It's a matter of opportunity. Just like Krishna says that for those who are very advanced, those who make good progress in yoga, then they take their birth. Suchinam Srimatam Gehe. So they take birth in certain families. What is the significance of these families? Are taking birth in these situations is that you have the opportunity to serve Krishna. It begins with a rich family. See, if one's born in a wealthy family, then one does not have to expend one's energy like a shudra, struggling simply to fill his belly. All of that is taken care of. So then that person, the mind is more free to inquire into the meaning of life. And plus in such elevated families, there is that, by the birth, there is intelligence. This is one of the, it's material. Who is it? Queen Kunti. She speaks of this, what is that, these four things? Janmaishya Shrutya. So Shrutya is the second one, or third one. Janma, birth, Aishwarya, opulence, Shruta, education, and then Shri, a beauty, bodily beauty. So in a good material birth, these four are available. And they're conducive to Krishna consciousness. They don't equal Krishna consciousness, but they're conducive. It's a good situation, a good platform by which one can take the opportunity to develop Krishna consciousness. And then Krishna says, of these fortunate souls, the most fortunate are those who actually take birth specifically in the family of transcendentalists or devotees. Because then they specifically get the opportunity to hear about Krishna, to serve Krishna. But it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity. Still they can, people born in such, you see it all the time in India, go to Vrindavan. You see plenty of examples of people. Although they were born right in Vrindavan, I mean, they learn about Krishna while they're still within the womb. Because in these families, they do, the mother's reading Bhagavatam and for the benefit of the baby, and all of that is there. But still after birth, then you can see it. They may choose not to be so serious. You see, when everything is handed you on a silver platter, it's a good opportunity, but you may think, yeah, it's so easy, and then not take it very seriously. So you see, this is what it comes down to. It always comes down to choice, to our choice. In any situation, even your birth in Vrindavan, you still have to choose Krishna to take full advantage of it. Any other questions? Yeah?
It's not contradicted, because Queen Kunti, she says in that verse that actually these four things, when one is attached to these things, of course, that they're stumbling blocks for surrendering to Krishna.
Yeah, well, that's just, that is the point. She says that only one who can call out to the Lord with feeling. Only that one is actually making, you know, progress in Krishna consciousness or coming to the pure platform of devotional service. So, but you've explained it. One who's attached to these four, and then that is difficult, because they take these four pious results as being the result. You see? But they're four material results. They don't take the opportunity that they present, but rather they just take them as they are, as being the result, and enjoy them. In this fourth canto, the Kumaras, Sanat Kumar, he speaks on this. He says that a devotee will accept as a blessing a good station in this material world. Just accepts it as a blessing. But one should always avoid the ignorance of, Prabhupada uses the term hedonism. Hedonism means the propensity to enjoy sense gratification. So along with these nice positions, blessings of the Lord, there is always the possibility of hedonistic pursuits or sense gratification. So Sanat Kumar says this is ignorance. So even one is born in the mode of goodness, that potential for ignorance is there. If I try to enjoy the mode of goodness, then that is the mode of ignorance. And by that I will fall down. So to be in goodness but not enjoy it. One is in goodness but one doesn't endeavor to enjoy goodness, rather one endeavors to serve Krishna. That is the ideal position. Yes?
Sometimes they ask what is the highest good according to Vedas. So can we say that the highest good is that what is good to the God?
And which is what?
Which is good to the God, which is...
good to the
God.
Good to the God. God.
Highest good is Krishna Aika Sharana. To be fully surrendered to Krishna. Out of 26 qualities of the Vaishnava, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that one is essential. And all the others are, they will naturally follow. You see? It's just like a train. You see? A goods train. So you can have so many, many cars filled with good things. But in order to send these goods to where you want them to go, you have to have the locomotive. That is essential. Otherwise, you can have... In the States, there used to be these huge locomotives which could pull 9 miles of wagons. You see? 9 miles of goods. Those were, they say, in the days when railroad was king. That was the foremost, before airplanes and all that. So it was the foremost means of moving goods around. So you can imagine, you may be so fortunate as to have 9 miles worth of of boxcars filled with good things. But if you don't have a locomotive, then it's not going anywhere. You can't do anything with it. So this is the point. So the essential ingredient or essential virtue is to be surrendered to Krishna. All others follow that. Okay? Srila Prabhupada ki jai.